Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is another repeat guest that I'm happy to welcome back, Shannon. So, Shannon, thank you for joining me.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure.
So tell the people, if they don't know that much about you, tell them a little bit about yourself.
I am a geek, have been for quite a while, and currently also a teacher of scary high school students.
Oh, dear.
But, you know, sometimes the two worlds collide and it's fun.
So when I was in high school, I went to a geeky high school, Regis High School in New York City, for anyone who's listening. Hello, fellow nerds. So kind of being a nerd was more socially acceptable in my particular high school, I think, than in other high schools. And this was, I went to high school when, 1991 to 95, I guess, because I graduated in college in 99, and it all makes sense. Yep. So this was pre everybody's a nerd, and, you know,
right.
Hundreds of thousands of people are flocking, or millions of people are flocking to see comic book movies and all this stuff that, you know, and you see, like, grandmothers reading Game of Thrones on the bus and stuff like that.
Oh, dear.
It's true. I, you know, when that explosion of Game of Thrones interest happened, all of a sudden, I started seeing the most random people reading Game of Thrones everywhere, which I embrace because I think it's a good book, but it was just weird. So my point is, when I was in high school, it was not cool to like this kind of thing, but I was in a super nerdy high school, so it was kind of okay. But yet still, I played D&D and read fantasy novels, so that was still really not cool. So my question to you, Shannon, since you teach high schoolers, is it cooler now to be a nerd slash geek than it was in the Dark Ages? Or is it still pretty not cool?
I think it's not that it's cooler or not cooler as far as what a person likes, as much as the things that teenagers like these days, they are embracing more of what used to be geeky. So it's mainstreaming it, kind of.
There, I gotcha.
You can still find the students who, you know, are obsessed over the one thing, and they may or may not fit in with some of the others. It depends on their personalities. But I am just as likely to overhear my students discussing Game of Thrones or Harry Potter or Marvel movies. And, you know, if I, you know, jump in and, you know, mention, oh, yeah, I've seen that. And it's just like, whoa, she's on to us.
Quick, we have to talk about something else.
Half of them do that, and then the other half start excitedly, you know, asking me about, you know, do you watch, do you do this, do you do that? And I have to say, no, I read the first three Game of Thrones books, threw the third one against a wall, and never looked back.
I've heard that before, so yeah. It's not for everybody. Yeah, it's just that's a good way of thinking about it, that, you know, the popular culture has shifted to a nerdier, or, you know, I guess, Doctor Who is popular, Game of Thrones, Star Wars has always been popular, but I feel like it's even more popular than it ever has been. Star Trek still not as popular as I would like it to be. I don't understand, but
You know, the movies, I think the current movies are helping. You know, I see some kids are into them, some adults that I know that are very into them, and some of them have been Star Trek fans all along, and some of them are beginning to go back and look at what started these movies. It just depends on which path.
That's true. All paths should lead to Star Trek. And plus, there'll be a new show soon, so hopefully that'll excite some people to joining the Star Trek family. But we're not here to talk about all that. Well, we are here to talk about Star Trek in particular. But you're also on a Babylon 5 rewatch.
Yes, that my main podcasting gig is the audio guide to Babylon 5. We are just over halfway through the original five-year series, and my husband and our friend Erica Ensign and I are rewatching the show week by week and pulling it apart every 2 weeks and having a grand time.
So the episode that we're going to discuss today happens to be a Deep Space Nine episode. For a lot of similarities between Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5, not just the number in the title, right? In particular, for the people who already know what episode we're going to talk about, it is the Hippocratic Oath. There's no the Hippocratic Oath. They dropped the article. Season 4, Episode 4. And so my question to you is, I must admit, I think I admitted this when you were last on, that I have not watched much Babylon 5. And that remains to be true. because I said I would give it a try.
And, one of these days, when you have time, you know, you get through the other 500 episodes of this podcast and then plenty of time.
Exactly. There's just so much stuff to watch. Yes. And plus I watch, you know, mindless reality TV, which I feel bad about, but it's like popcorn. It's so delicious. and now all the politics stuff, I'm watching all that. It's so much going on. Although probably safer to watch Babylon 5 than all this politics from either side.
Yeah.
But my point, we're nonpartisan here at Random Trek, so don't send me any angry emails or tweets. My real question before I got sidetracked into dangerous territory there was, what do you think the main differences between, I mean, or one or two differences between Deep Space Nine and Babylon 5 as you see them?
I think the more I see, I started watching Deep Space Nine. I'd been a TNG fan and watched most of that run. And I started watching Deep Space Nine, but into season two, early season three, somewhere definitely before Worf arrived, I had stopped watching regularly, whether it was watching other things. Grad school had started kicking in around that time for me, so very busy, and I didn't have as much time for media. So at the time, based on that, I would have said that Deep Space Nine was this uncomfortable effort to balance the two ideas of episodic TV versus arc TV. Mm-hmm. But having seen this episode that I had not seen before, and reading through, doing a little bit of research on what was going on around this, I see that Deep Space Nine, I think, started to embrace arc TV more the longer it went on. Or at least that there was an overlying conflict with the Dominion and the Gamma Quadrant stuff that they maintained, which was something I definitely don't remember Next Generation doing in its run.
Yeah, so, Next Generation did not. I mean, they had a couple of, you know, multi-part episodes, but no arcs there.
Yeah.
And so Babylon 5, though, if I am correct, kind of started off with, like, from the get-go, we're going to have long story arcs, and it was kind of a groundbreaking thing, right?
Yes. When J. Michael Straczynski, the producer, creator, and head writer of Babylon 5, started planning this, his entire vision was, we're going for 5 years, it's going to be a novel for television, there's going to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there is going to definitely be an end. We're not going to, like, keep going and keep going. So he always had a plan for a major story arc with some undercurrents that that he held on to through several seasons at a time. It didn't gel as nicely as he would have liked because for the longest time, it looked like the at that time, the series had finally gotten to TNT, if I remember correctly, and there was a question whether TNT was going to renew them for their final season.
Oh, man.
So season four turned into this sort of crammed, kind of rushed, you know, we've got to finish the big story arc. And then they said, yes, you've got a fifth season. So what was left, you know, he came up with something else that tied in. But because the biggest action was already done, season five is a little bit weaker in a lot of ways than some of the others plot-wise. There's still some great character stuff, things like that. But you can tell that, you know, what happens when your plan goes awry.
And that must be so, I mean, I'm no TV executive or TV creator, but I assume that must be very frustrating on both sides. Even, you know, especially if you already have a five-year plan. But then, you know, just thinking about Castle, which is one of those shows that I watched, that, you know, suddenly it seemed like they decided, okay, this is the last season, but after they had filmed the last episode of the last season. So I don't want to ruin it for anyone who is DVRing Castle and doesn't want to know the end of it, but it was clearly they had to film, like, an additional scene because of what happens at the last episode.
Yeah.
It would have been... I should say no more, but TV is a cruel mistress, is basically what I'm saying.
Yes.
So Deep Space Nine, as you were saying, first couple of seasons, it was really episodic and kind of your, I don't want to say run of the mill, but kind of your prototypical Star Trek stuff happened. it didn't seem to have any impact on the next episode, and it was all kind of, you know, encased and encapsulated, easy to dip into, easy to, you know, just pick up on. As we get into the later seasons, so, later in season three and season four, really picking up on it, it is very much of an arc. And the last season, especially for someone who runs a podcast in which we watch random episodes of Star Trek, is going to be challenging because it is basically like a 20-episode story arc.
Wow.
So it's going to be challenging. But that's what makes Deep Space Nine my favorite Star Trek, is because it has such a complicated tapestry of a story going on. And some of that is all about the Dominion and the Jem'Hadar, who feature prominently in this episode that we watched. But someone else who, before we, when I assigned you this episode, I said, oh, it's a Bashir-focused episode. And I expressed my dislike of Julian Bashir, which I think, you know, every
time... And then I confessed a guilty secret.
That's right. Would you like to share your guilty secret?
I crushed on Julian Bashir those first couple of seasons. I did. Alexander Siddig is just, you know, he's a very handsome guy. Mm-hmm. And he brought those first couple of seasons, this puppy dog eagerness to do the right thing, to be the best. And, you know, I really enjoyed the character. You know, he's certainly not everybody's cup of tea, but he spoke to me for whatever reason. And it was kind of nice to come back to this episode to see that they have let him mature. They've let him develop more leadership and these kinds of things. And, you know, based on this one episode, I like the character even more.
Yeah, so the first I had I will not argue he's an attractive man. I just found the first couple of seasons of Dr. Bashir to be grating, just because, and I think that was a choice on their part to have this character be like, you know, golly, gosh, darn it, I'm on the frontier and I can do frontier medicine and this is awesome.
And that's good. I mean, that's not the kind of character you'd seen in the previous Star Treks that I can think of. That, you know, everybody else was a bit more serious and, you know, they were there to do a job and they knew what their job was. And the closest you got was, you know, like the Wesley Crusher character. And he had an excuse because he was a teenager.
That's true.
So to have somebody else coming in, you know, all fresh and eager and thinking they know what they're doing and finding out just how difficult this job is a nice difference. It was nice to see somebody who was capable in his skills and knowledge, but needed to learn better to interact with this new team in this new place.
Right. And this is a theme that's also touched on in this episode, although with Worf as opposed to Julian Bashir. Because Deep Space Nine, one of the other things that I really like about Deep Space Nine is that it's not set on a Federation starship, so it's not all Federation people, all super confident and super, well, maybe not some, super competent, that's what I meant to say. But they have to deal with, you know, Odo and Quark and other red folks that kind of just live on this station. And
this felt more, of all things, this resonated with me more as something that I could see happening on a Babylon 5 script. Oh. A lot of these things, especially the Worf side with the new guy in town who's got to learn how things operate in this enclosed environment. Mm-hmm. They are no longer traveling to this planet, do something by that planet, do something by, and never see any of them again. In a situation like Deep Space Nine or Babylon 5, where the setting is fixed, you know, consequences happen. They linger. They, you know, things affect and change people. Because they can't get away from each other. They can't just go away and never look back.
Because that's where they live. All their stuff is there.
Yep.
Our first sponsor for Random Trek is the officially authorized by CBS Studios official Star Trek Starships collection, available only from Eagle Moss Collections. I've been talking to you guys about this collection for a couple of episodes now, but believe me when I tell you that these little ships are not little ships you'll want to break. Captain Picard, I'm looking at you. These ships are so highly detailed that it's amazing. I used to think that the Hallmark ornaments were highly detailed, but these things put those to shame, and the best part about them, they come fully assembled, they're painted, They come with a little stand, and they are made of this crazy material that the Eagle Moss people have sourced, I assume. The extensive collection features the most significant vessels from across all five Star Trek series and each of the movies, from the motion picture through the just-released Star Trek Beyond. And like I was saying, the specially cast metallic resin is fantastic. It really feels sturdy. And these things are hand-painted with reference to actual CG models used in production and photos of the original studio models. I know you're saying, but Scott, this sounds too good to be true. But wait, there's more. In addition to each ship, you also get a display base, which I talked about, plus a collector's magazine featuring behind-the-scenes info, original design sketches, and a breakdown of the technology on board. I know you're eager to sign up. When you start your collection today, you get the USS Enterprise 1701D from The Next Generation for only $4.95 with free shipping. New models ship twice monthly and are delivered directly to your door, and you can cancel your subscription at any time. I don't think you're going to. For details on the entire collection and to order, visit st-starships.com/random. That's st-starships, starships.com/random. Thank you to Eagle Moss for sponsoring Random Trek. There's a scene between, we're jumping around, but that's fine. There's a scene between Sisko and Worf where, mm-hmm. you know, Worf is, you know, he's bristling at, he doesn't understand why Odo doesn't want his help and why everyone is not just basically saying, hooray, thanks, Worf, you're great, mm-hmm. when they just want him to do his job. And Sisko basically says, listen, you're not on the Enterprise. Not everyone's in the chain of command. You just kind of have to learn how to deal with people, and it's not going to be as clear-cut as it was on the Enterprise, which yeah. I thought is a great thing. That was a great moment, and you could see Worf, because Worf is not known to be super flexible.
Yeah, it reminded me quite a bit of when they first introduced the character as a regular in The Next Generation, because, you know, there he, you know, even though he'd been in Starfleet for a while, you could still see him finding his way, balancing his Klingon background and his upbringing on Earth with this starship. So, you know, like, you know, in season two, there were flashes of what he's dealing with in this episode back then, too. And right. I like that they revisit to the fact that if you keep moving in life, you keep learning.
That's right. You don't want to get stuck in a rut. And although it seems like Worf in this episode is kind of like missing the ruts.
A bit, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't even thought of that. It's true, because the first season of TNG, he's basically, I'm not
kind
even
of
sure.
in the background.
Yeah,
it's like,
no, what does he even do? I don't even know, because Tasha Yar is in charge of security. He's just there
as part of security.
Like just chilling and doing whatever he's told. And then all of a sudden, he's thrust into, spoiler alert for TNG, by the way, Tasha Yar dies.
Yes.
And this episode, I forgot how new, you know, quote-unquote new Worf is to Deep Space Nine. Mm-hmm. He's obviously a very familiar character to Star Trek fans, but this is only the fourth episode, right? He comes in the first episode of the fourth season, so which is a two-parter, so technically this is the third episode, but whatever. So he is really kind of really trying to settle in, and you can tell he has been a security officer for so long that he is having some trouble shifting into, what is he now, like a strategic something
He's
or other.
Basically organizing Starfleet for the station.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which seems like a big important job, but yet he's obsessed with this person who he thinks is a smuggler and is smuggling crystals, and he's really, really annoyed that Odo will not arrest Quark.
Right.
Which I can understand, because Quark is always up to something.
Yep.
But this is another lesson of, well, you know, yeah, we all know Quark is always up to something. But if we arrested Quark every time he was up to something, who would give us drinks?
Yep.
And so, you know, you just have to go with it. And then, you know, this episode doesn't deal too much with Odo and Quark's relationship at all, but they have a really interesting relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find out, so there's an A plot and a B plot. The B plot is the one we're spending most of our time talking about right now, which is Worf trying to settle in, and he thinks that, you know, Odo is basically not doing his job. And so he keeps going to Odo's office and is like, here's some more information about the smuggler, and here's, I found, you know, Quark mm-hmm. is stealing these, has the scanner that can only be used for these crystals that aren't allowed off the planet. And Odo's yep. like, okay, dude, thank you for telling me.
Goodbye.
That's right. But, yeah. You know, Odo thank is you, not, not up for small talk.
No.
And neither is Worf. So they have very efficient conversations. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, but it all turns out, so basically Worf gets increasingly annoyed, and he decides, okay, I'm going to have to stop this myself, because nobody else cares. I'm the only sane man on this space station who is not fooled by Quark's charms. And so he, you know, Quark turns out meets this person, and he's got these illegal crystals, and Quark is about to buy them. And Worf, you know, busts up the drop, I guess, or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever the kids call it now.
Yeah.
And Odo is actually there in the form of a bag.
Yes.
And this, you know, it's always interesting. I bemoan on this podcast often that Deep Space Nine is not in HD. It hasn't been remastered.
Right.
And then when I watch Odo, the special effects for Odo, I realize they're never going to make this HD because it'll take forever to redo all these special effects. So I think that I'll just have to pretend that the special effects look better than they do. Although when they were on TV and I saw them for the first time, they blew my mind.
Mm-hmm.
They are not so yeah. mind-blowing anymore.
Yeah.
And it's very slow, and I'm like, oh, maybe Odo's just trying to transform slowly for the sense of drama.
Well, I mean, he's got, you know, he was this little tiny bag, and he's got to get back to, like, full-size human. That
yeah, that's true. I don't know how the mass compression works in right. Odo. Or maybe that bag is just really heavy. We don't know.
No, we don't.
And then so Odo's like, oh, you messed up this whole thing. I don't really care about this guy. I wanted to sneak into the whole syndicate and bring them all down. Thanks a lot, Worf. And then Worf's right. like, I didn't know. And then Odo's like, of course you didn't know. It's not your job. Do your darn job, Worf.
Yeah.
Leave me alone. And Worf's like, I'm sorry.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. And so that was interesting. Sometimes I feel, well, a lot of times I feel like the B plots are kind of throwaway and they just need mm-hmm. to fill time. But I thought this one was a very good glimpse into watching Worf as a, you know, fish out of water, trying to do the mm-hmm. right thing, kind of doing, you know, following Starfleet regulations, quoting regulations to people,
right,
and then realizing that's not quite the way things work here on the station. And if you want anyone to talk to you, maybe you should cut that out.
Right.
yeah. Which is interesting, right? Because that's, you know, he's bumping against his oath to the Federation. And then the A plot is, you know, Julian bumping against his Hippocratic oath to, you know, do no harm and mm-hmm. try to heal these enemy combatants, basically. And O'Brien really having none of it.
Yep.
And being like, listen, we are leaving. This is wrong. I'm out of here.
Yep.
And so I thought that was an interesting kind of tension between both the A and B plots. And I think when we talked about Julian Bashir, I told you that by himself, he generally annoys me. But when you add O'Brien to the mix,
mm-hmm.
I find the two together to be delightful.
Right.
Because I feel like they have, you know, they're so often on TV, there are many things that aren't well represented on television shows. One of them, I think, is kind of mature male friendships.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice to see two guys that are just friends, and they're actual friends, and you could tell that they really care about each other, and they work together, and they have like a normal, friendly relationship. They're not rivals. They're not trying yeah. to, you know. So that's nice to see.
Yeah, I thought that was a good thing as well for anybody who, just for whatever reason, this was their first DS9 episode, having that initial conversation between the two of them as, mm-hmm. you know, O'Brien's complaining about, you know, his wife, you know, is, you know, there for brief periods and then gone for long periods. And Bashir, you know, the single guy who's, you know, has had no romantic success whatsoever. He's been mm-hmm. chasing Jadzia Dax, as far as I know, for a couple seasons.
Yes, and unsuccessfully.
But here he is, you know, doing his best to offer advice and be supportive and it helps to show that they're on the same team, because then it makes their divergent opinions later on that much more tense, I think.
Yes, because it, you know, it establishes in a very short period of time that they have a friendship and that, you know, they have that kind of relationship where he can talk about his wife and their relationship and try to get advice. And they're not just like, you know, forced to be on this survey mission because they hate each other. Although I did think it was funny when O'Brien was like, ah, Keiko is upset because I put a workshop in our bedroom.
Yeah.
And I was like, as a man who has been married for a while, that's not a good move, O'Brien.
No, it's not.
And he's like, but I only do it when she's not there. And I'm like, still probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
And you can see Julian is thinking, that's not a good idea. But
I'm going to be supportive. And
exactly. And spin it.
Yeah, I'm going to spin it for you and help you out here.
Exactly. And then we get that weird part where O'Brien's like, I wish she were more like, and he was going to say you, and then he decided that would make this all weird. And so he says a man, and then Julian's like, you want your wife to be a man? I don't know. And I just thought, given their... They could have played that in a way that made it off-putting, but I feel like it was endearing, and you knew they were just kind of kidding each other, and so it all worked.
Yes.
At least in my opinion. That's a very brief scene. They're on a shuttlecraft, or a runabout, actually, in Deep Space Nine lingo, for people who are keeping track. Yes, I know what I'm talking about. they detect some energy signature, right? And so they say, well, they're Starfleet officers, so they got to go check it out.
Yes.
They go check it out. Oh, no. There's an uninhabited
planet.
Exactly. But it's an uninhabited planet. What could possibly go wrong? They crash.
Yes.
There's an energy weapon of some sort that drains their energy. They crash. The uninhabited planet.
Not so uninhabited.
No, it's full of Jem'Hadar.
Yes.
Maybe full might be an over-exaggeration. There are like eight of them.
Yes.
But the Jem'Hadar are fearsome warriors, and even one is tough enough, but having a whole bunch of them is no good.
Right.
And so the Jem'Hadar, for the people who are listening to this podcast, haven't watched the episode and know nothing about Deep Space Nine, are the kind of the genetically engineered foot soldiers for the Dominion, which is this, I always forget what quadrant they're from. The Delta Quadrant? No, the Gamma Quadrant.
Gamma.
There you go. Delta Quadrant is a Voyager. And so the Dominion, whose leaders are the Founders, are this big multi-race spanning alliance that don't want the Alpha Quadrant people in their quadrant. And so there's some tensions. And they are fearsome warriors who have super cool self-cloaking devices. They look kind of like humanoid dinosaurs, I guess.
Yeah, kind of.
And the cool thing about them, I mean, there are a couple of cool things about the Jem'Hadar, but the most interesting thing is that they worship the Founders as gods, because that's what the Founders genetically engineered a couple of races, the Jem'Hadar and the Vorta. So the Jem'Hadar are the soldiers, the Vorta are like the admin people.
Okay.
Because, you know, every Armini needs a good administrative level.
Mm-hmm.
You need the bureaucrats. So the Jem'Hadar are fearsome warriors, right? And it's dangerous to have super strong people that are genetically engineered to fight because you need some way to control them, right? They could, otherwise they'll just take you over. So what does the Founders do? They make them a drug addicts, basically.
Yep.
And they require this thing called Ketracel White. And so all of this is to explain that these Jem'Hadar are stranded on this planet. And they are running low on their Ketracel White.
Yep.
And bad things happen if they don't get their Ketracel White.
Yes.
Unless you're one particular Jem'Hadar whose name I am going to try to say. what is it? Garanganar? Is that?
Yes. That's what it looks like anyway.
Okay. And so he, apparently, he was stranded on this planet by himself or something. He was stranded somewhere. He ran out of Ketracel White. He went through withdrawal symptoms. And theoretically, they are supposed to not be able to survive. They don't need to eat. Mm-hmm. They don't need to drink. They need Ketracel White. That's it. And if they don't get it, they die.
Right.
Well, he ran out of his Ketracel White, but he's alive. He kicked it. He doesn't need it anymore.
Exactly.
He did the 12-step program.
The hard way, but yes.
Yes, he did. I don't know if he has a keychain or not, but and he wants to help his friends or his, I don't know, well, that's hard. The Jem'Hadar relationships, I don't know how they relate to one another.
Yeah, he's still a commander,
Yes, so his troops.
He cares about the squad of his.
Ah, squad, that's a good thing. Yes, so he doesn't have a lot of Ketracel White, but he wants them to not be addicted to it. because he's got all kinds of radical ideas now because he's not addicted to these drugs.
Yes.
And, you know, out of heaven falls a doctor and an engineer. And I did enjoy their first meeting where mm-hmm. both the doctor and O'Brien just readily tell them, oh, yeah, I'm a doctor and I'm an engineer. Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, maybe you wouldn't tell them that immediately. I don't know. But then they're like, oh, well, engineers are typically more valuable, so we'll just kill the doctor. Because right. Nobody wants to rescue a doctor. And then Garanganar realizes, oh, he's a doctor. Maybe he can cure everybody of their Ketracel White dependence. And so that basically is the kernel of the A-plot, right? So,
yeah.
And O'Brien is not a big fan of the Jem'Hadar. He is a warrior himself. He's mm-hmm. fought, and he's not an officer, right? So Julian yeah. Bashir is technically his superior.
Right.
Although they don't really have that kind of relationship generally, but technically he is his superior officer. Mm-hmm. And so that comes up because, you know, Julian is like, hey, I don't want to help these guys. Let's try to escape. And then he starts talking to Garanganar, and Garanganar is like, well, you know, the founders are gods. But and this was a really good scene. I thought he talks about how I've never seen a founder. I hear there's a founder on Deep Space Nine.
Right.
And
which was something else I like that this episode was referring to things that happened in previous episodes. That's mm-hmm. something else I don't remember happening much in The Next Generation until maybe the last season or two.
Yeah, it always drove me crazy when, you know, these amazing, crazy things happen. And then the mm-hmm. next episode, everyone's like, yeah, well, we're not going to talk about that.
Yeah, but here you had specific references to previous things about a Jem'Hadar being on Deep Space Nine mm-hmm. and how they had a founder there that was able to deal with it. And that leads us into this conversation as Garanganar explains the relationship between the different races.
Yes, and I really like the part where he says that, so we worship, the founders are our gods, except they don't answer our prayers, and they're not waiting for us in the afterlife. And I thought, that's a moving thing to say when, you know, because at that point you realize, okay, this guy has realized what's going on, and he's mm-hmm. questioning all of his assumptions. And that's what Julian Bashir realizes, okay, it seems like racist to say he's humanizing himself, but
he's certainly falling into what Bashir would like to see.
Exactly. He's no longer just a walking death machine.
Right.
He's starting to think critically and,
he wants the injured soldier healed, not just, killed off as dead weight.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All of these decisions.
And so Bashir's like, okay, maybe I should help you guys, because if maybe what's happening here is you don't have the Ketracel White anymore, your Ketracel White addiction, so now it frees up your brain to start thinking critically, and you can mm-hmm. make your own choices, and I'm a Federation officer and a doctor, so this is kind of my oath is to help you people. And
that's
I really
our title. Yeah.
Exactly, that's right. And O'Brien is less on board with this plan.
that was one of the things that I really liked about this plot was it's a classic conflict setup of, mm-hmm. you know, the person acting out of compassion versus the person acting out of caution, I guess, not necessarily fear, but, you know, the person who wants to play it safe versus the person who's willing to put himself out there to try. And they just, you know, clash two or three times in this episode. This argument comes up in different ways about, you know, why they should help versus why they need to leave, to the point where they basically just, you know, a couple times they each go their own way mm-hmm. as best they can, since they're both still prisoners of right. these guys.
And our final sponsor is another familiar sponsor. It's Star Trek, the Starfleet Academy experience at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum. This is the perfect opportunity to celebrate 50 years of Star Trek. The Intrepid Museum in New York City is the first venue in the United States to host Star Trek, the Starfleet Academy experience. So if you're in or near New York, you're going to want to channel your inner Spock and go embark on a 12,000 square foot interactive journey. Now you get into the exhibit, and it tests your skills and knowledge to see what specialization you are most suited for. Language, medicine, engineering, navigation, command, or science. And when you complete your training, you're commissioned in Starfleet. They give you a communicator and a phaser, and you go off and fight the Borg. No, that's not true. Although you do get to go to the exhibit, and you can see original costumes and props from Star Trek series and the movies. And, speaking of props, the Intrepid Museum has the Galileo shuttlecraft from the original series on display. So you can get your picture taken with it. I have been told you're not allowed to touch it, so keep your hands to yourself, mister. The exhibition is open now for a limited engagement through October 31st, which is Halloween. Spooky. You are not going to want to miss this. Now you'll get $5 off using the special promo code TREKKIE. That's TREKKIE. And that's good for up to 4 full-priced adult, child, or senior Star Trek tickets only. You can use this promo code online or at the box office, but it cannot be combined with any other offers. Isn't that offer good enough for you people? The offer expires, of course, the last day of the exhibit, October 31st, 2016. Now, if that wasn't enough, which it clearly isn't, for Star Trek fans of all ages, you can also do Star Trek overnight, experience Star Trek After Hours, and you can watch Star Trek movies under the stars, see the Galileo, visit the Space Shuttle Enterprise. Oh yeah, by the way, did I mention there's a Space Shuttle there? Everyone gets to take home a swag bag with Star Trek and Intrepid souvenirs, and you can find out more information at intrepidmuseum.org/StarTrekOvernights, all one word. The Intrepid Museum is located on Pier 86, West 46th Street and 12th Avenue in New York City. Visit intrepidmuseum.org/StarTrek for tickets and information. Boldly go. Yeah, I mean, so they are being held prisoner. And so O'Brien is basically, listen, I know you want to help them, and I know that feels like the right thing to do, but what's going to happen is that you're going to help them, and then they're going to kill us both. Which, you know, based on interactions with the Jem'Hadar previously, that is not a crazy thing to think.
No.
But, you know, O'Brien is kind of, his character is known to not be the most open-minded about militarized aliens.
Yeah.
And so he's had some experiences in his past where, you know, the Cardassians in particular have taken him as a prisoner of war, and he's seen things, man,
yeah,
that Julian Bashir has not seen. So Julian, yeah, is this, I think he even calls him an idealist, and which is, you know, a laudable quality to have, but when you're trapped on a planet with hostile forces who have you prisoner, maybe you should escape.
Mm-hmm.
Which, and that's what I think makes this episode so interesting, because I think they're both right.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, the resolution when the commander realizes they've run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
O'Brien has shot up what Bashir had set up for an experiment to try and figure out through blood samples what might be done. O'Brien tries to force him to leave by shooting up the experiment and destroying it. There's no time for Bashir to do it again before the supply of drug runs out for the rest of the soldiers. And the commander realizes it. Gonagar realizes he tried, he played his hand, and he's lost. And what he does is he sends them back to the roundabout where they can leave. Bashir wants him to come along. I mean, you know, he's obviously not of the mindset. He can help. Bashir wants to continue to help him at least, but he's a commander, and O'Brien understands why he chooses to leave. The assumption is he's going to kill all of the men so they don't suffer the withdrawal symptoms. And as you said, everyone's right and no one's right.
Right. It's one of those.
And that is something that, you know, you might see once in a while on original Trek or TNG. Once in a while, they might go there and present you with a situation in an episode where it's not tied up in a neat bow at the end. This one I thought was done really well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, you know, this is one of those episodes where the A and B plot just kind of serve to highlight each other's, because, you know, once again, going back to that scene with Sisko and Worf, which I think may be the only time Sisko is in this episode.
There's two scenes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because there's one where he's playing with the baseball. That made me squeal, because I remembered the baseball thing.
Yes.
And then the other one, he's playing with this, like, he's crafting something or building a model. I don't know what he was doing.
I assume it's some Bajoran thing that he's building, because he likes the Bajoran culture. Uh-huh. Yes, you're right. And so, but there, I don't remember which one, which scene in which he's playing with something.
Right.
This happens, but he does say to Worf, listen, there, you know, you're used to the Enterprise and being on a starship where everything is black and white and people, there are regulations and everyone follows the rules. Mm-hmm. You're going to find out here on Deep Space Nine, there are a lot more shades of gray.
Yep.
And you're going to have to, you know, use your best judgment, but everything's not going to resolve itself easily. And that's exactly what we see happen on the planet with Julian and O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and this is, you know, the other interesting thing. So that he, Garenganar, is the commander and he cares about his men. And between O'Brien and Bashir, Bashir is, you know, technically O'Brien's senior officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he does explicitly order O'Brien.
Yeah, he does pull rank a couple times.
Yeah, he's like, we are going to do this. I have made my decision. We are helping. O'Brien, you need to go get the mm-hmm. equipment and the scanners and all that stuff, right? And the, of course, O'Brien then takes the opportunity to turn one of their scanners into a weapon, but...
and do something with the teleporter, the transporters, which he always does.
That's right. He's very good with the transporter, that O'Brien.
Yes, he is.
And yeah, so I thought that was a good scene where he is, you know, he has to go get some part from the runabout. I don't even mm-hmm. know what. And you know, we clearly see there's... I question the UI of this, but in this hatch there's like a little alert that tells you that the transporters yes. are online.
Yes.
Which makes perfect sense. You'd want to, you know, open a hatch to see if the transporters are online or
right.
not in
yes.
a dedicated panel.
Yeah.
But it makes for it easy to zoom in on with your mm-hmm. camera shot, and so we can, the viewer can see O'Brien look at it, and then we can see, you know, the gears turn
yes.
in his head. And so, you know, I really like O'Brien. He's kind of plucky, and
mm-hmm.
he's kind of very sure of, he has a very certain moral compass. And if it, you know, goes against his orders, he doesn't really care because he wants to do what he thinks is right.
Mm-hmm.
And Julian, you know, Julian has his Hippocratic Oath, and he is going to try and do that because that's what he thinks is right.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both trying to do the right thing. Yeah. But coming at it in a very different way.
And at the end, that neither one of them feels like they've won anything. I mean, you know, of mm-hmm. course, Bashir did not succeed in the task that was presented to him. He could not find a way to break the addiction for the other soldiers in the squad. He, you know, any ideas or dreams he had about changing the entire Gamma Quadrant politics by freeing the Jem'Hadar, you know, to make their own destiny, you know, there's no way that's ever going to happen. And O'Brien, you know, does not feel good about the fact that they're getting out of there. Yes, they're getting out of there, but the commander is going to go kill the rest of these men and then either, mm-hmm. you know, live out his lonely days on this planet or kill himself. Who knows?
Right. Yeah. And you can sense that, you know, I've never been a soldier, but
right.
there's in all of these media portrayals, there always seems to be a kinship between soldiers, even if they are mm-hmm. on opposite sides of
right.
the conflict. Right. So, you know, O'Brien feels for these guys, even though he doesn't want to help them in particular.
Right.
But he knows that and that was what you mentioned, the scene where Garenganar, you know, Bashir's like, well, just come with us. You'll be fine if you come with us. And he's like, no, I can't. And he turns mm-hmm. to O'Brien and says, you're a warrior. You explain. And he leaves.
Right.
And I thought that was really good. You get that moment between mm-hmm. him and O'Brien. And
yeah.
also Garenganar proves that he is in fact a changed man because he escorts them to their runabout when all the other Jem'Hadar just want to kill them. So,
right.
And I think he kills one of his soldiers who pops
yeah.
out and to protect Julian and
yes.
O'Brien. And at that moment, you could see O'Brien's like, oh, maybe Julian was right, but we still need to leave.
Yeah.
Which at that point, yeah, you got a lot of angry Jem'Hadar, so you better get going. Especially after O'Brien blew up any hope they had of mm-hmm. figuring out what was going on. Which I thought was perhaps a bit too far, but...
but, you know, he was as convinced, as he says towards the end, every single one of his actions was to try and save his life and Bashir's life
mm-hmm.
and get them
it's
out.
True.
That was his one purpose, even as Bashir's purpose became trying to help the enemy.
Yes. And then he, you know, O'Brien says, well, you know, sir, I think he calls him sir, you can mm-hmm. you can write me up or,
yeah.
you know, when we get back to Deep Space Nine.
Mm-hmm.
And Bashir basically says at the end, there's this, you know, so we had that, it's kind of a book ends, right? Because mm-hmm. at the beginning we have this lovely, they're joking around and it's clear they're friends and all chummy. And at the yep. end, there's a lot of awkwardness between them and they kind of, you know, Doc and O'Brien says, Julian basically says, I'm not going to write you up. You were just trying to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien's like, all right, well, let's go. Maybe we can have a drink or something. I forget exactly what he suggests. But let's hang out, basically. And O'Brien, and Julian's like,
in a few days.
Give me a little bit to, because he's very upset about these things, which is understandable. He did give O'Brien an order, and O'Brien disobeyed it. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien's kind of like, well, you know, we're both alive. Let's celebrate. My wife is not here. I can show you my workshop. and Bashir's having none of it.
Nope. Not yet.
Not yet. They spoiler alert for probably the next episode of Deep Space Nine that follows this one. Julian and O'Brien continue to be friends.
Okay.
And that is, I think, also the wonderful thing about Deep Space Nine is, and I talked to, we did an incomparable about Star Trek Beyond, and mm-hmm. I talked about, you know, people are talking about, you know, what real Star Trek is, and this is real Star Trek, and that's real Star Trek, and I think that's craziness, and there's no such thing as real Star Trek, as long mm-hmm. as you enjoy it, that's Star Trek enough, right?
Yeah.
For me, what I enjoy most about Star Trek is the characters and their relationships.
Right.
And Deep Space Nine shows the relationships changing and, you know, they're not always getting along together. They're not always, mm-hmm. you know, everybody's peachy and singing Kumbaya. And there's some conflict, basically, between the characters, the main characters. And that's something you really didn't see a lot of in TNG or the original series.
Right.
There were conflicts with external folks, but mm-hmm. internally, everybody's kind of on the same page. So it just makes it interesting.
Yeah. Or even if they argued, there was an easy solution where one of them clearly had to change his mind or follow the other.
Right. Or like, you know, Picard. If Picard gives you an order, you're going to follow it.
Yeah.
Or else bad things happen.
Yeah.
So what did you think, Shannon, of this episode overall?
Overall, I enjoyed it. Having gone to read a bit more about this is what was going on in the season, sort of fitting in since I had not seen this part of Deep Space Nine before. It's actually turned out pretty darn well, given that the originally there were two different stories being tossed around by two different writers, and a producer was like, hey, wait a minute, let me try fitting these together, and winding up doing so. The one storyline wanted originally O'Brien and Bashir in conflict with each other. But at first, this was Lisa Klink writing this one. She sort of had the idea backwards because O'Brien was the one sort of feeling sympathy with whoever the enemy was in her original draft, and Bashir was the one fighting it. And, you know, after like a couple of pass-throughs, they realized, we need to flip this around. Okay, but now what do we do? And another writer, Nicholas Correa, had the grains of the idea of the Jem'Hadar and their drug addiction being what was controlling them as the army for the Dominion. And, you know, what if some of them tried to break their addiction? But from that mishmash developed a pretty elegant story.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising. I'm surprised whenever I read, you know, the production notes of any mm-hmm. TV show that any of these shows that I watch get made, because it seems like it's just craziness.
Yeah, and it's double for me because, you know, as I said, you know, my main focus at the moment is Babylon 5, and J. Michael Straczynski wrote a good chunk of episodes in season 1 and season 2, and then he wrote the entirety of season 3. Every single episode was written by him to make sure that everything was lined up and where it was supposed to be. And as it turned out, he wound up writing the rest of the show through seasons 4 and 5, except for one episode that was done by Neil Gaiman.
And these were 24, 26 season episodes?
22, I think.
That's a lot for one person to be doing.
Yeah.
Well, Shannon, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Always have fun.